I've preached a few times previously on the Hindu tradition. It feels auspicious to return to Hinduism this morning, since today is the beginning of Diwali, the annual Hindu festival of lights. In Sanskrit, Diwali literally means a row or series of lights and has the connotation of lights that illuminate knowledge. I want to show you just a few photos here at the top, and they really merely scrape the surface of the truly dazzling wonder that is Diwali. Have any of you ever been to a Diwali? Okay, I see just a few hands. There's another. So I wanted to start with pictures of Diwali to give you a sense of how much this holiday truly is a symphony for the senses. Religion, especially in the West, is often presented as like debates about textual interpretation. That is really not what religion is about. Religion is about so much more than the interpretation of ancient text. Religion is about myths. It's about these stories of meaning making that we pass down to our children. It's about rituals. It's what these things we do with our bodies. It's about traditional sights and sounds and meals and smells and so much more. Along these lines, I found this recent social media post quite meaningful. It's from Neil Katal. He's a law professor at Georgetown University. He's argued more United States Supreme Court cases than any other minority lawyer in U.S. history. He's kind of a big deal. If you look closely at that photo, now it's pretty small print, on the right you'll see the seal of the United States Vice President. Katal shares, "When I was growing up, I hid Diwali from my classmates. No one knew what it was. And now, it is being celebrated at the home of the Vice President of the United States with our first South Asian and African American Vice President. It is beyond my wildest dreams that that is true." In the lead up to Diwali this year, I've been reading a book titled The Stories Behind the Poses, the Indian mythology that inspired 50 yoga postures. It's by Raj Bokarana, who's on the left. Part of what I most appreciate about his book is that he's a scholar practitioner. Often you get people that are either like really into practicing yoga or sometimes people really into Indian philosophy, and he's really into both. He's this renowned academic of Hindu mythology as well as a yogi who has apprenticed himself to an Indian master for more than a decade. Now, the perspective I'm going to be sharing with you today is pretty universal, but I don't want to give the impression that like his interpretation of Hindu poses is like the one true interpretation, because if you know anything about Hinduism, it is this wild, variegated tradition, you know, incredibly pluralistic. So this is one among many possibilities. So don't at me later. Personally, yoga has been one of my spiritual practices for more than two decades. Who's into yoga? All right, quite a few hands. My interest started in seminary. I was attending divinity school in Fort Worth, and one of my friends was regularly driving the 3 hours to Austin because it's a much cooler city. Fort Worth is actually really cool, but Austin wins. Though it's now become really gentrified. You know, it used to be like keep Austin weird, and now it's like for the billionaires, but that's another sermon. So my friend was training to be a teacher in the Ashtanga yoga tradition. Any Ashtanga fans out there? Okay, I see just a hand or two. The next time I was in Austin, I went with her. So my first yoga class was in this very hot, heated room with some impressively advanced, like Ashtanga is pretty hardcore. I was in decent shape. I could keep up with them through maybe like the first two-thirds of the sequences. But toward the end, I just sat down and watched because I can't do that. Or that. Or that. And after more than two decades of yoga practice, I still can't do any of those sort of truly hardcore poses. And to be honest, I no longer aspire to. Now, when I was in my mid-20s, I'll be honest, I did harbor some ambitions to do these kind of advanced stages of yoga practice. I've, in the end, gone there more with meditation instead of yoga. But I've come to realize that I get a huge amount of benefit from some really basic yoga practices. I'm really okay being pretty basic with yoga. And there's a significant risk of injury, actually, from some of the advanced practices. Not really that, with the balancing ones, more with the more extreme twists and bends. You can actually take those too far. If you want more information about that, I'm a huge fan of this book, The Science of Yoga by William Broad. It came out about a decade ago. In addition, many of you will know that Irene Glass and I have led more than 20 three-hour yoga meditation teacher retreats right here in the sanctuary. We clear out the chairs. We stopped offering them during the pandemic, but maybe we can get back to them in 2024. Yeah, they're really great. So if you're yoga curious but haven't ever really tried it, my favorite yoga mantra is that if you're saying that you're too stiff to do yoga, that's like saying you're too cold to get out of the freezer. There are also modifications that can be done from a chair. Our regular series of yoga classes here at UUCF is a great place to start. You know, if your schedule allows, details are in our weekly e-newsletter. I also like to underscore that if you don't have time for a full yoga practice any given day, you're feeling really busy, a significant amount of benefit can come from just pausing for a second and asking yourself, like really asking with curiosity, what one or two yoga poses does my body most need? You don't have to do 45 minutes or an hour. It's great if you can, but just ask yourself, like, what one or two poses? And then no more than, even just 1 minute would be fine, but like 1 to 5 minutes, you know, doing 30 seconds a minute on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 poses can be surprisingly transformative. If I'm really busy and have to pick just one pose, for me, it's often pigeon. That's pigeon pose. It helps counterbalance muscles that, for me, really get tight from running. So your mileage may vary. Pigeon may not be your jam. You have to experiment with what works for you. In the spirit of Dr. Balkarana being a scholar practitioner, I'll say just a few words about yoga from an academic perspective, and then I want us to dive into just a few of the stories and myths. And I'm not even going to be able to, I could really tell like just one full story, so we're not even going to have time for, I'm just going to give you these kind of snippets and summaries of some of the stories. If you're curious about all 50 and all the details, you're going to have to check out the book. But as Wendy Doniger, who is a religion professor at the University of Chicago, has traced, yoga as we know it today is a fairly recent blending of cultures that actually resulted out of the British colonization of India. Although some philosophic practices of yoga go back millennia, contemporary postural yoga, the kind of asanas and the flows that we know it in today, was actually invented in yoga in India in the 19th century, so the 1800s. And international yoga that is now spread around the world is compounded from this unlikely mix of British bodybuilding and physical culture, American transcendentalism and Christian Science, naturopathy, Swedish gymnastics, and the YMCA, all kind of grafted onto this Indian. I really promise you, it's like all of this stuff kind of came together. The truth behind the history of religious beliefs and practices is that they're almost always much more complex and ever-evolving than most people are willing to admit, especially the fundamentalists of any particular tradition. And although yoga can be beneficial both physically and spiritually, without knowing anything about these Hindu stories and myths that I'm about to share with you that are behind the poses, a knowledge, at least to me, a knowledge of the Hindu tradition can add this profound depth to yoga practice. And as we prepare to hear some of the stories and myths behind the yoga poses, just consider these opening reflections from Dr. Balkarana. He writes, "Storytelling is no ordinary thing. We're storytelling creatures. Story is really, really powerful." He says that while science is the arbiter of the empirical world, myths are tools for meaning making, most importantly about what it means to be human. Myths mirror the complexities of life. Sometimes people say about myths, myths are stories that never happened but always happen. Right? They never happened historically, but the universal truth in them happens again and again and again. They are maps for the human journey. They are dramatizations of the inner life. They broach life's big questions and life's mysteries. So this book of myths and stories is for seekers and lovers of stories. It's also for those who wish to deepen their yoga practice. May we be open to the wisdom of these ancient stories as well as the somatic wisdom of our bodies. We've done whole services about that before, right? Mindfulness you hear a lot about, heartfulness, but also bodyfulness, right? Opening to the wisdom our body has. So without further ado, let's get into it. We'll start with something relatively straightforward, mountain pose, or Tadasana. Now, if you're feeling as you start to see this, like, I don't think I can listen to this sermon about yoga and stay still, then I want to give you permission now or at any point, if you want to get up and go to the back, behind the back row or spread out in the atrium, like, go for it. Do some yoga. So I'm not going to go through the accommodations for each pose, but a chair yoga adaptation for mountain pose could look like just sitting a little more upright in your seat. So you can do that right now, to sit a little more like a mountain, whatever that means for your particular body. For this relatively simple pose, perhaps some of you are thinking, I don't know, man, why bother? Is this really yoga? I think I'm just standing there. You know, is this yoga in any meaningful sense? Well, at least in my experience, I promise you that practicing mountain pose, even for a minute or so, will leave you feeling more grounded, more attentive, and with a more solid foundation to go throughout your day. That you may find yourself kind of going through your day and just getting in a conflict or something, and maybe because you did mountain pose, you'll feel a little more grounded in your feet, a little more connected to the earth. When you stand and know you are standing, because most of us are kind of mindlessly going through the day, to stand and know you are standing, really giving yourself a chance to feel into that posture in an embodied way, you will feel a shift. Dr. Balkarana writes, the mountain pose is no ordinary standing. This is the standing of trees. This is the standing of pyramids. This is the standing of mountains. In Hindu mythology, mountain pose invokes the god Shiva, who along with Brahma and Vishnu is a member of the Hindu Trinity. Like Shiva, mountains are grounded, secure, enduring, majestic. He is the yang principle to support the yin of flowing Shakti energy. He is the riverbed without which the river could not flow. Now, I grew up Southern Baptist, and so as yoga became more popular, the whole thing was people wanted to say, this has nothing to do with Hinduism, right? It's not true. I'm glad that that kind of got spread because it allowed yoga to spread, but to me, I want the Hindu spirituality. I think it's deeply moving and compelling. For our second pose, we can make just a slight shift, and you can do this one from your chair as well as you'd like, to just shift your arms into prayer pose or pranamasana. Here with our bodies, we are cultivating reverence and centeredness and inwardness. You can see if you can feel that shift. In Hindu mythology, a reverence pose invokes the god Hanuman, who is an ardent devotee himself of the god Rama. So, you know, whomever and whatever form our guru or teacher takes, we are called to respect them, to succeed in receiving all that they have to give. Now, that doesn't mean mindless or unquestioning obedience, right? That's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about reverence, bringing our attention to heart center, which is so crucial in mutual devotion flowing between teacher and student. For our third pose, and you might have to go to the back if you really want to do this one. I'll show you a chair variation that you can do if you're not going to knee your neighbor. So for our third pose, we're going to take it up just a notch. So here you're going to require some skill in balancing. So tree pose or vrikshasana. With this pose, you're embodying and cultivating greater connection and stability and openness to growth, right? Because sometimes tree pose kind of spreads out. And here is another chair accommodation. So maybe some of you can do that if you're not going to get too intimate with your neighbor that way. It's important to emphasize with yoga that poses are not about performance. This is about experience. This is about experience. Dr. Balkarana writes that from the perspective of the Hindu tradition, tree pose is simple, but for those who know the great wisdom behind it, it is actually one of the most profound yoga poses. In this pose, one's hands are clapped, closing the circuitry of heart energy. Also, one's two legs become like a single grounding rod connecting with the earth. The upright plane between the sky and the earth is divine. It's the plane of Kundalini, that divine feminine energy rising of spiritual ascension, of touching the transcendent while rooted in the earth. So Kundalini energy, if any of you have ever experienced this, is when energy shoots up your spine. Our fourth position, dog pose. You're going to have trouble doing this one in your seat. Or Savasana will likely be familiar to anyone who has visited at least probably a U.S. yoga studio, unless it's some kind of obscure tradition. In most contemporary traditions, it is a position returned to quite regularly throughout the practice. It'll also be familiar to dog owners. Because most dog breeds naturally into bow, into downward dog. Cats do it too. That's true. Fair enough. Like its canine namesake, this pose embodies and cultivates loyalty and ferocity and power. Mythologically, this is another Shiva position where Shiva is invoked. Dr. Bakarana writes, Shiva is sometimes called the Lord of Beasts because his refined consciousness is said to be able to effortlessly tame wild animals. So upward-facing dog has to do with working with wild canine energy, as my dog does anytime we pass another dog. The head is above the heart, activating the upward flow of Kundalini. Downward dog is a calming pose. It offers the grounding presence and the companionship of a tame and loving dog. The head is below the heart, grounding into the earth. And if this pose or any other yoga pose becomes too much, you'll often hear many teachers say, at any point during this practice, you can return to child pose or balasana. Spiritually, child pose invokes Krishna, an avatar or incarnation of Vishnu. That's another member of that Hindu trinity mentioned earlier. Krishna symbolizes divine play, and this pose embodies and cultivates grounding and safety and serenity. One of the important concepts in the world of Indian philosophy is that of lila. Lila literally means play. This doctrine views mundane reality that we're in right now as resulting from the play of the divine. Play occurs when children feel safe and lose themselves in the moment, and we have a lot to learn from children in that respect. When engaging in this pose, you're invited to connect with the calm grounding of a child who feels safe and secure and protected by their parent. Now, at the risk of shifting too radically from child's pose, I did want to go deeper into one of those wild poses that I showed you earlier. So let's turn to a hand balancing, I cannot do that one, a hand balancing pose called Astavakrasana, sorry. Here you're cultivating focus, because you need focus here, right? Skill is quite skillful, as well as equanimity. Are you impressed? I'm impressed. A surprising number of people can do this pose. Here's another example. In Hindu mythology, Ashtavakra is said to have been a sage of great wisdom. That's the sage that this pose is named after. He was often misjudged for his physical appearance. The story of teaches us the importance of humility, that blowing out someone's candle doesn't make your light shine any brighter. It just diminishes the light available to you and others. So this tale is an important reminder that appearances can be deceiving. This ancient sage was judged prematurely on the basis of his age and appearance to the detriment of all concerned. Any such prejudice, it only blocks us from receiving the divine gifts that others have to offer to us. This pose challenges us to find the comfort in the discomfort and to be of poised mind no matter how bent out of shape our circumstances are in any given moment. And I would be remiss if I did not end with corpse pose or Savasana. Many of you who have done a long, sweaty yoga practice, when they finally say corpse pose, you're like, oh my God, thank you. Right? Like you're ready to sink back into the earth, and that's part of the point. It tends to be the final pose in many contemporary yoga practices. So on your back, on the floor, relaxing and releasing as completely as you can, you're cultivating inner stillness. At the end, again, of this long, sweaty practice, perhaps some of you have been in corpse pose and felt your sense of self melt away, if only for a moment or two, allowing you to just be. Don't miss that metaphorically ego death is what we're talking about. That sense of ego just slips away for a second. You're just in the moment, in the flow. That ego death is part of what corpse pose is about. This pose is another one that invokes Shiva. Not surprisingly, since his nickname is Shiva the Destroyer, right? The destroyer of your ego. There's a story of the time when the goddess Kali withdrew her presence from Shiva, and without Kali's Shakti, divine feminine energy of play, and its relationship to desire, Shiva was left as little more than a corpse. The invitation then with this pose is to cease becoming for a while and to embrace being. Through the practice of divine inertia, the capacity of witnessing from stillness can accompany you into your day as you move through the turbulence of life. So I've only shared with you a kernel behind, you know, the stories of each pose. If you're curious to learn more, there's so much more detail, so many more stories and poses in this book. For now, I'll leave the last words to our author about how we can continue to apply some of this ancient wisdom from the Hebrew tradition. So what have you learned about yourself and others? What have you learned about the world? What have you learned about yoga? Like any great teacher, these stories will meet you where you are, and they will take you to the higher vantage point, which as high as you're currently able to go. And they will do this over and over and over, no matter how many times you revisit them. The stories don't change, but we change, right? And they change us. They mirror the point and point to the mysteries of life and to the path of greater vistas of awareness. Especially if you go through all 50, notice what stories kind of stay with you the most. Which ones do you remember? Which ones impact you and resonate with you the most? Which characters do you identify with and why? You can talk to your therapist about it, right? Why this character? What impact are they having on your yoga practice, your mindset, your behavior out in the world, off the yoga mat? Often the point is not just what happens on the yoga mat, it's how it changes how we are out in the world. Just like it's not as much about what happens on the meditation cushion, how does it transform us in the world? At some stage, once you've integrated a particular story into your awareness, try your own retelling just off the top of your head. And notice what innovations do you make and changes to the story. Enlivened in this matter, these stories will continue to inspire, to entertain, and to enlighten, as those lights of Diwali do, to enlighten their tellers and hearers alike, as they have for so many millennia to date.